Welcome to Tim Bray's Ongoing Podcast, which is an audio version of a selection of the articles on my blog, also called Ongoing. I'm Tim Bray. You can find the blog at tbray.org. This is pretty well the same story you'd experience by reading it, but some people would rather listen. This piece was published on the 10th of June, 2022, and is entitled Making Code Faster. Now, a production note, I record these in my boat, which is also my office, and it's a warm day today, so all the windows are open, and I'm in the middle of a busy city waterfront, so there will be some background noise. I apologize, but I don't know. Let's say it adds the atmosphere. Making code easier. I've enjoyed writing software for 40-plus years now. Lots of activities fall into that writing software basket, and here's my favorite. When you have a body of code with a decent unit test suite, and you need to make it go faster. This is part of the Quamina Diary, that's a link, or this part of the Quamina Diary is a case study of making a piece of the library faster. How to think about it. When you're sitting down to create software, you probably start with preconception about whether and where there are likely to be performance issues. If you're writing Ruby code to turn your blog drafts into HTML, it doesn't much matter if republishing takes a few extra seconds. So, write the first cut of that software in the simplest and clearest possible way without sweating the milliseconds. But for code that's on the critical path of a service backend running on a big sharded fleet with lots of zeros in the per second numbers, it makes sense to think hard about performance at design time. At this point, I want to call out Nelson Alhaghi's Reflections on Software Performance. That's a link. Nelson approvingly quotes the following pieces of conventional wisdom. 1. Premature optimization is the root of all evil. 2. Make it work, then make it right, then make it fast. 3. CPU time is always cheaper than engineer's time. Well, I approve too, but sometimes it just has to be fast, and sometimes that means the performance has to be designed in. Nelson agrees and has smart things to say on the subject. And then there's the background against which I wrote the Quamina code. It's a successor to a similar library I wrote v1.0 of at AWS, and which is in production in multiple high-volume services, running hot. So I didn't have to speculate about the kinds of stress that would be applied, nor about what kinds of design goofs would produce bottlenecks. On profiling. Nobody is smart enough to figure out what is making a piece of code slow by looking at its inputs, outputs, and structure. That's why we have profilers. Fortunately for me, Quamina is written in Go, which means the profiler is built in, helpful, and doesn't even slow your benchmarks down much. The other two languages I've used mostly in recent decades are Java and Ruby, and the profiler situation for both those languages is kind of shitty. I had to pay real money to get the Java profiler I used at AWS, and while it worked, it was clunky, not fun to use. Now, at this point, I should note there was a comment which said that these days Java actually does come with a good, free, high-quality profiler. I can't testify to whether that's true or not, but a couple of people said that. Whatever language you're in, have a look around and find a good profiler you can live with, and keep it handy. And if you're in GoLand, go read up on the profiler, that's a link. Avoid the official docs Google turns up, they're outdated and useless. The Go profiler has a very decent command line that will show you readouts in a local HTTP server, or textual tables, or export it as PDF. I find the latter easier to use, but you know, your mileage may vary. But what I actually use is the built-in profiler module in GoLand, JetBrains Go IDE. There's a Run with Profiler button, and when you hit that, the first thing you get is an IDE pane full of flame graph, which takes a little while to figure out, but once you do, it's brilliant. It might not always show you what your problem is, but it sure as hell shows you where to look. Here's one of those, which it's a picture of a flame graph. I'm not going to describe it, but I'll read you the caption. The middle bump is loading the test data. The right third is profiling overhead, I think. The app logic is in the left third. It suggests we have a close look at a function called store array element field, and oh, we will. The GoLand profiler module lets you walk around the call graph and seek out hot methods and so on. I never wanted it to do anything it couldn't. I'm not going to do a how-to on the profiler. It's not hard to learn, and you should learn it. Anyhow, most of you kids are in VS Code these days, which I assume has good profiler support. And having said all that, the graphics below are the PDF output from the Go profiler, no IDE involved. Gotta have those tests. So you understand what the performance problem is, and you have a profiler set up that you know how to use, but just like it says in the first paragraph, good unit tests are totally essential, because the profiler is going to show you a problem, and you're going to refactor and rewrite to fix the problem. You can do that fearlessly if you have a high-coverage unit test suite that you can run with a single key combo and comes back in 10 seconds or less. Otherwise, sucks to be you, because when you refactor and rewrite, you will break things. Guaranteed! But if you've got that unit test backstop, you don't need to worry because you'll find out right away and can iterate till it passes and find out if your work helped. If you need to speed up code and it doesn't have decent unit test coverage, well, then writing the unit test is the price of admission, which at the end of the day is just another reason to never let anyone check code in that doesn't have tests in good shape. benchmark choices. With a profiler and unit test, you have two legs of the tripod. The third is a nice data-driven, repeatable benchmark. I use the San Francisco Parcels JSON file, and that's a link, a couple of 100,000 JSON objects comprising 190 meg or so, big enough to get meaningful measurement, small enough that Quamina can run pattern sets on it in a second and change. The San Francisco JSON objects have several large arrays full of 19-digit floating-point numbers, which is pretty well a worst-case scenario for the flattener, so most people will see better performance than we do while we're testing. Finding a good benchmark dataset is a good investment of your time. Backstory. V1.0 of Quamina's ancestor at AWS, I've been calling it the Matcher, was about fast enough for EventBridge, so it didn't really get any optimization love. Then when other services started picking it up, we started hearing the occasional gripe. In particular, some team down in the bowels of CloudWatch wanted to use it for something and benchmarked it against a few other options that looked slow to me, and the Matcher won, but not by very much, at which point it occurred to me to profile it. Did I ever get a surprise? As discussed elsewhere in this diary, matching patterns to events is a two-step process. First, you have to flatten the event into a list of path name value fields, then you run the matching automaton. When I fired up the profiler, I found that the matcher was spending like 90% of its time flattening events. Ouch. I'd been using a popular JSON library to turn the event into a tree structure, then running around the tree structure to peel out the fields, which requires a whole lot of memory allocation. Bzzz, wrong! Anyone with significant optimization experience will tell you to keep memory management off the critical path. Some of my biggest optimization wins over the years have just come from pre-allocating buffers. At AWS, I juiced up the flattening code but can't remember most details, except for I used a streaming JSON partner. Cheap JSON. Well, I wasn't going to do the same dumb thing twice, so my first cut at Quamina's JSON flattener used Go's JSON packages tokenizer streaming API. That's a link. Thus, I was pretty disappointed the first time I profiled a big Quamina run and saw the flattener burning 99% of the time, and then again when the method burning most of the time was some internal thing with malloc in its name. A couple of minutes research revealed that, yeah, that API is known to be slow, and yeah, it's because it gobbles memory like a hungry teenager. There are a couple of alternate community-built tokenizers. I looked at them, but for some reason, nothing really appealed. Also, I'd like for Quamina to have the minimum dependencies, ideally zero, just because that makes it easier for people to adopt. Also, I realized I had a couple of advantages over someone writing a general-purpose tokenizer. As I mentioned before, one of Quamina's designed-in optimizations is that once you've added a bunch of patterns to an instance, you know which fields you need to look at while matching, and crucially, what you can ignore. So while you're flattening, you can skip over lots of fields, and for that, the memory cost should be zero. Second, to match field values, Quamina uses a byte-driven automaton to support things like star and numerics, so there's no need to turn the field value into strings or numeric data types. Everything can just be a byte slice. And since a message coming in from outside is also a big byte slice, there's really no need to allocate anything for subslices, and that only for the fields you care about. Thus was born FlattenJSON, which is a link to the code at GitHub, a complete but not general-purpose JSON tokenizer in 750 lines of Go. It's a collection of finite state machine mini-parsers, one at the top level, then sub-parsers for objects, arrays, numbers, string values, and so on. As of now, it still takes more time to flatten than match an event, but it's close, which means the whole thing sped up by a factor of about 5. Well, what's next? Time to declare victory? Well, let's break out that profiler again. Here are reports on CPU and memory utilization. Here we have pictures of PDFs with boxes in various colors connected by arrows of various thickness, which I'm not going to try and describe. One of them is for CPU and one is for memory. But the caption says, above, CPU profile. Below, memory profile. You can enlarge them, but if you want a quality view, there are PDFs for CPU and memory. Those are linked. For people who are learning the Go profiler, this command produce the files, and here's a shell command that I'm not going to read off to you. If you want to copy and paste it, you need to go visit the blog. And here are the command lines that generated the PDFs, two more shell commands. So what is the profiler trying to tell us? The CPU profile makes it pretty clear that the flattener is spending the bulk of its time managing memory. Names like memmove and refill alloc cache are a giveaway. In an early revision, the heavy-hitting methods had GC in their names, so at least now I'm avoiding the garbage collector. If we look at what called the heavy hitters, or alternatively just glance at the memory profile, it's pretty obvious that the routine store array element field is our prime suspect. Let's have a look. And here, it's a little routine. It's only like 5 lines of code, of which one's the top one's the signature and one's the closing brace, only three lines of code really. I'm not going to read it to you, but I'll read the comment, which is, store array element field adds a field to be returned to the flatten caller. Straightforward, except for the field needs its own snapshot of the array trail data because it'll be different for each array element. Note, the profiler says this is the most expensive function in the whole matches for JSON event universe, presumably because of the necessity to construct a new array trail for each element. Yep, it makes a new field struct, and then gives it a copy of that array of array pause structs, and then appends the new field to the list called fields. It's that array copy that's getting us. Can you think of anything that might reduce the pain? Well, I can, but only because I know what this thing is all about. To match correctly, you need to know about the arrays and the element you're matching so that you don't match fields from different array elements. For example, if you have an array of objects each representing one beetle, you don't want a match of first name Paul, last name Lennon to work. Anyhow, if you run through a long array, it turns out that each field only needs an array trail copy in case it has child nodes that append more stuff to the trail. So if you made the array trail segmented and fields could share segments, you could probably reuse the path segment so far and avoid a lot of the copying. Or you could think about having an array of star array pause rather than array pause, so you could share steps and only copy pointers. Both options would introduce complexity, and the second might not even be a big performance win, because later in the matching process you have to run through the array and look at each element, and you'll lose a lot of memory locality as you go fetch them following all those pointers. So, will I go after store array element field at some future point? Maybe, if I can think of something simpler. Got any good ideas? Quamina is already pretty fast. Takeaways. Test. Benchmark. Refactor. Iterate. It's not fancy. It is fun. I have been known to whoop out loud with glee when some little move knocks down the runtime significantly. How often do you do that at work? And that's all, folks. If you really care, there's a big, this one got to the top of Hacker News, and there's a big Y Combinator comment, but I didn't think it added that much value. But anyhow, you could go and look. Anyhow, once again, that's all, folks. Thank you.